Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. Good to have you all with us today. Before we jump into our conversation with Dr. Baron Lerner and Marsha Oakley, just a little tidbit about what happened in today's world many years back. This is May the 16th, and on May the 16th in 1979, A. Philip Randolph died. A. Philip Randolph, of course, was the president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, the first black leader of the AFL-CIO. He was a socialist, a radical, an organizer, a man who confronted Franklin Delano Roosevelt, as some mythology reality has, to say we want African-American rights now. We want to have rights when it comes to employment in the docks. We want to have rights when it comes to serving in the military, or we're going to have this massive march on Washington. We have had programs on his life before, and I think we should just remember this was his day. This was also the day of the beginning of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising in 1943 in Poland during World War II. That anniversary was significant because we all think that people went off to the concentration camps. But there was a story of many stories like that of people resisting that led to the massacre of people in the ghetto. But those are two things that happened in our world many years back. And now we're going to take a look at the world of breast cancer from a number of different perspectives. The entire country, much of the world, was kind of taken by the op-ed written by Angelina Jolie. There's been, as many people said, asking questions, should I have this double mastectomy now? Because I may be prone to having breast cancer. And it's a really big issue for many people. Most of us have been affected by cancer one way or another in our families. We were in our house. We are joined here today by Dr. Baron Lerner. He's a medical historian, professor of medicine at New York University, Langone. Did I say that correctly? Medical Center, author of The Breast Cancer Wars, and Marsha Oakley, nursing coordinator at the Hofberger Breast Center at Mercy Hospital, a breast cancer survivor herself. And Marsha Oakley and Dr. Baron Lerner, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Baron Lerner, let me start with you, and I just take us back. I was reflecting on this actually with my wife, who had breast cancer. Her mother had breast cancer, which eventually killed her a long time ago. And the kind of Holter procedures that were in vogue then are not in vogue now. So I'd like you to just kind of talk a bit about the history of breast cancer in America and how we've treated it for a second, to give us kind of a sense of where we are today from where we were then.
Well, it's a very interesting story, and it, as you suggested, began in Baltimore with William Halstead at Johns Hopkins, who invented this new procedure, the radical mastectomy, which was a very large operation for breast cancer, where the breast and the lymph nodes and the chest wall muscles on the side of the cancer were removed. And Halstead thought if you did a big enough operation early enough, you could cure women, really for the first time. And Halstead was really onto something. The problem was that people kept doing that big procedure for years and years, decades really, after it became clear that you didn't need to do as big a surgery if the cancers you found were smaller, like through mammography. So the women really revolted in the 1970s and pushed doctors to stop doing such dramatic surgery. Eventually, clinical trials were done, which indeed showed that for early-stage breast cancers, you could either just remove the breast or do a lumpectomy and radiation. So up until now, the story of breast cancer treatment has been one of cutting down the surgery, doing less and less, which makes the Angelina Jolie story so interesting, because here are women now pushing for more surgery after that long history of doing less surgery.
I think that's one of the key issues here. And I want people to join us here at 410-319-8888. I know many of you have gone through these struggles around breast cancer. You have your own questions and thoughts about it all. And we'd like to have you join us here, 410-319-8888. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages, Mark Steiner and The Mark Steiner Show. You can tweet us, as people do now, at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. And Marsha Oakley, let me start with you and then kind of go back to Dr. Lerner on this. I mean, what I've discovered from talking to people is that since Angelina Jolie's procedure and her conversation about her procedure, it's done a couple of things. One, I mean, people are talk about the bravery of her talking about it and what she did. And that's on one level. And the other, I think many women are really now kind of up in the air. confused. What do I do? Does that mean this is what I have to do to prevent cancer? If in fact that the BRCA1 or 2 gene is going to affect me?
Well, I think what this announcement by her has done is it's reignited conversation on breast cancer and breast cancer treatments. And in fact, in this morning's paper, there's an article that says, you know, this revealing has definitely restarted conversations within families. I've been doing this since the late 1980s, when you didn't talk about much at all. And it was now then trying to find, as the physician said, better ways to do surgery, lesser surgeries. And the other thing that also has impacted how women do this now is better reconstruction. You know, in the 70s and 80s, there was only one thing you could have, which was either a mastectomy, and most people didn't have any kind of reconstruction. And if they then, as we moved into the 80s, had reconstruction, it was a tissue expander or an implant. So we've gotten better ways to do reconstruction, and so women are better able to then make some informed choices. But I think you have to keep in mind, there's only 5% that we know currently who are, you know, families that would be BRCA positives or BRCA negatives or worth the testing. And so the majority of women, when they are diagnosed with breast cancer, are not immediately running off to have testing done. What they should be doing is talking with their physician regarding their specific cancer and the treatment that they're going to have. And that's where, for the most part, for the first time, women are being asked in depth, you know, family kind of histories. Do you know when your mother was diagnosed? Do you know what kind of cancer she had? How about genetic testing? So we see at the Breast Center at Mercy, we see women who are coming in. Many of them, yesterday I had a 30-year-old woman, her mother has had 2 breast cancers premenopausal, and she's made this decision, just like Angelina did, to have bilateral mastectomies, and she will tell you, the reason I'm doing this is I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and I want to be here. And if I can go from an 85% risk factor to 5% or less, that's why I'm doing this.
And so, Dr. Lerner, what does that mean to go from the 85% to 5% risk factor? And given that some of the articles I read late last night and early this morning, we're talking about that there are treatments that can be as effective in terms of finding breast cancer and without double mastectomies. So I wonder how we counsel people. How do we address this? This is very not just a medical issue; it becomes a very emotional issue for people.
Yeah, it's very tricky. You know, you hear statistics like 85% versus 5%, and you're like, you know, running to the surgeon, right? Women, like, why wouldn't I do that? But it is more complicated. For one thing, as was pointed out, most women are not gene positive, so women who are at high risk but don't have the gene, it's nowhere near 85%. And there are things a woman can do to lower that 85% figure, and one of them, for example, is working on your diet, cutting out fat and other things from your diet. Another thing is to take pills that are anti-hormones like tamoxifen or raloxifene to lower your risk. And breast cancer can usually be detected pretty early. You can get your mammograms. You can examine yourself. There's no guarantees. But you don't necessarily have to have your breasts removed. Each woman should talk to her doctor about options for risk reduction.
Because even psychologically, Marsh Oakley, where we are now, is that when you... On the one hand, years back, and I was thinking about this after reading Dr. Lerner's piece, one of the pieces he wrote for Huffington Post, and in his book, that you know there was a period of time when a lot of women activists, health activists, would argue that a woman's breasts were essential to who she is, and that they should be the last thing we think about doing. But now you hear the consciousness about women saying, "Look, this doesn't define me as a woman." I mean, this is what I'm talking about. These are things that people have a hard time wrestling with. Now, how does that fit into your counseling of all that?
Well, it's tough. It's really tough because even though we're in 2013 and it has changed for most women, there are still women for whom this is huge. And because it's a huge issue, you know, they really struggle with it. We live in America. You know, we still have an emphasis on breasts and Women still look at that, and there are definitely populations of women that's their fear, that they'll somehow be changed if they have to have this surgery. I spend a lot of time talking about, you know, after the surgery and what happens and, you know, need for support and who's going to be there to help you. I think we also need to say this is all being focused on breast, but there are BRCA genes for ovarian cancer, and there's no screening mechanism for ovarian cancer. So that's still one of those pieces that when you say BRCA, there's breast, but there's ovarian. And breast, yes, we can do wonderful ways of screening, but ovarian, we have poor ways of doing screening.
And that was something, Dr. Lynn, that I think that some people are also concerned about after hearing what Angelina Jolie said, because she brought in the issue of ovarian cancer. And so many people are kind of worried, is this connected?
Yeah, I mean, I've had some patients who with the gene marker, and they are much more concerned with ovarian cancer for the reason that we just talked about, which is that there is no screening for that. I mean, that cancer is much more likely to be detected in a later stage, and the treatments are not as good. So even, ironically, women with more of a family history of breast cancer will consider having the ovaries removed. And again, many will say, I've had my children, right? And I don't really need them anymore. And, you know, again, if you're high enough risk and you really consider all your options, it's certainly not unreasonable, again, for the women who are at the highest risk. I think women in general, for the possibility of having ovarian cancer, shouldn't be going around trying to have them removed.
410-319-8888, give us a call, and we have our two guests with us here, Dr. Baron Lerner and Marsha Oakley, nursing coordinator at Hofburger Breast Center, and Dr. Baron Lerner, both a medical historian and professor of medicine at the New York University Lagos Medical Center, author of The Breast Cancer Wars. 410-319-8888, we'll check on our Facebook page and see who's written in, join us for your questions and thoughts. So what about the issue of, again, when you're talking to people who really are considering having a mastectomy, and I know numbers of women who have, and people survive well, and life goes on, and I think we do in some ways in our own kind of sexist world make too much of it on one level. On the other hand, what about drugs like tamoxifen? What about another kind of Evistin, other drugs that might go to prevent breast cancer? I mean, what's their effectiveness, and how does that fit into these dialogues and questions, Dr. Lerner, and then go to Marsha Oakley?
Well, they're effective. I mean, the studies show, and again, you have to look at different populations. Some of the studies are with women with the gene, without the gene, but they reduce breast cancer risk, you know, in the vicinity of 50% or more. So you're 50% or more less likely to develop breast cancer if you take them regularly. Now, they do have side effects, right? So they're drugs and things like blood clots and other things that can potentially occur with that. So they're not quick fixes either. But for women who really say, you know what, I really don't want new breasts. I want to keep these, and I want to do whatever I can. There's certainly effective drugs to add into the mix.
Marsha?
I would agree with that. I think that there are effective drugs, but I also know that those drugs, as Dr. Lerner said, have side effects. So, you know, you are looking at, we call them chemopreventative, or, you know, that's kind of the word you'll hear around, or, you know, you're trying to prevent this breast cancer. And so patients who've perhaps had a family history, or women who have had a breast cancer, but they still have both breasts, or they've had a breast cancer with a mastectomy, they still have a second breast. So these are good drugs to take. They require monitoring. I mean, they should not be taken so you get one prescription a year and you never see anybody till you get it refilled a year from now. Because they do, as Dr. Lerner said, there are the risks for blood clots. There are the risks for bone issues. There are patients who go on these medications and they have such horrendous arthritic symptoms that then they need to be switched around. So there are other drugs. Tamoxifen is the one that's been around the longest, but there's one called Femara, which is a newer one. There are other drugs in what we call aromatase inhibitors. So there are other drugs that need to be monitored by, and we insist that they be monitored by a medical oncologist.
I mean, and we spend a lot of time talking about genetics and breast cancer, but we mentioned this just a little bit at the top of the show. I mean, but let's do it in a little bit more depth. That breast cancer, I mean, that the genetic root for breast cancer seems to be at the low end of the spectrum in terms of percentage of people who develop breast cancer, and that a lot of the research and work we're doing behind the scenes really are not kind of – not a lot of money, at least it doesn't appear from what I've been reading, is being spent on research of what may really be the underlying causes, Dr. Lerner, of breast cancer beyond genetics.
This is a great point, and it's a really hard issue. And when I was writing my book, you know, people were talking my ear off about this, and not a lot has changed since then. So many women focus, understandably, on their own breast cancer, their own personal risk, what they can do to screen early, what they can do to prevent breast cancer themselves. It's much harder to get people to focus on why is there so much breast cancer. And here you have to put things in like the environment and toxins and talk about that. And we do know, even though we say it would be more accurate to say 5 to 10% of breast cancers are hereditary, mm-hmm. in the fact that they are passed, the gene is passed from one generation to another. But almost all breast cancers probably involve some type of genetic mutation that is caused by some much more vague predisposition, plus some type of exposure that is hard to understand from the environment, from your diet, from other things. So it would be great to get more research into what can we do in the environment, what can we do in society to lower these things that predispose all women to breast cancer, not just those with a mutation.
Marcia, you want to comment on that as well?
I absolutely agree on that. But I guess because I've been the patient and because I sit in this office every day for the past 16 years, mm-hmm. that what you see are we've made great changes in some regard. There certainly are more women who are surviving. There's been a lot of money put into research, and my concern always is, do the researchers on the West Coast talk to the researchers on the East Coast? And, you know, I still think that I hope in my lifetime we know why we get this breast cancer. But I really feel strongly, particularly as the federal government begins to slash budgets for research, those things are going to happen whether we want them to happen or not. And there's great needs everywhere. So I think, you know, collaborative efforts to find the best from everyone and working together and not just sharing your own lab work with your own lab is absolutely going to be critical in the next years as these dollars get just shuffled around.
I mean, it's something over the last 20 years of covering issues in cancer and around breast cancer specifically that's become glaring in terms of where we invest our money for research.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Which is why there's been so much controversy over, do you want to participate in these marathons and runs? Where does the money really go?
Well, and I think, you know, I always remember my earliest breast cancer was in 1986, and I always remember saying there were no races, no funds. I mean, things that women today think about when they get diagnosed, I always say erase it all because that's where we've come from since 1985. And 1985 was when they released that big study, I believe that's the year, which said that women could have a lumpectomy, which was a lesser breast surgery than the traditional that we had been doing for all the other years. And I think that's the 1980s. So since 1980, we certainly have made some strides. But you, until you figure why and why do you recur, you know, why does that happen? There still needs to be research dollars, and they're going to be limited in the next couple of years, I'm afraid.
And I meant to read a quick Facebook message that came in. I'm not sure if I should read the person's name, so I won't. But I had a double mastectomy 10 weeks ago. I am BRCA2 positive and wanted to see my future grandchildren. Many people have put me down and told me I was stupid to have it done. I'm proud to have the surgery. Ovaries were done a few years ago. And hope and pray Angelina brings more awareness to this awful thing. Our BRCA gene is on the father's side, given to the women from the men of the family, quote unquote. And it's a good idea for women in families like this to get tested if they choose. This is so important to me. Baron Lerner, how would you respond to that?
She sounds like so many women I've met. I have a neighbor just on the other street who had this done several months ago. And, you know, I don't think she'd mind me saying she was high as a kite after she had it. Her mother had died of breast cancer. They had found some DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ, which is like a precancer in one of her breasts, and there was maybe some in the other breast. And she said, I just can't deal with the uncertainty. Did they get it all? Going back for more biopsies, and she decided to have both breasts removed, and she feels like she's so empowered and that she made the right decision. And yet she knows as well that other women might not have chosen that, but it's hard not to be happy for her and respect what she's done. Same with the woman who sent on Facebook. Sounds like she's gene positive, but it sounds like a very similar experience.
Does that mean, though, that as she and other people have said, that women in certain families should get this test? Is that it's a $3,000 test owned by one company?
It's expensive. You're correct. It's one company. It's $3,000. And what I always say, and I know our surgeons say, is when you get the test, what are you prepared to do with the answers? And so there are a lot of people who may not want to pay the $3,000, or their insurances may not pay for it. They also they may want to know, but then if they know that they're positive now what do you do? The patient yesterday, what she's going to do is have mastectomies now. And again, she's 30 years old, and she's going to hopefully get another 10 to 15 years of close watch before she decides to give up her ovaries. And so, again, that's very personal on her part. And I think that's what we see more and more.
As we lead into this next discussion, Dr. Lerner, since one company owns this test, if you can't, it's impossible for somebody to get a second opinion or a second test from somewhere else. Isn't that right?
Yeah, as of now. I think no one's calling into question the validity of the test at this point. I think scientifically it's been pretty reasonably shown. At this point, it's really a issue of patenting and money and who should get access to it. And, you know, it would be remiss to not mention in this story that, you know, not everybody's Angelina Jolie with money and access. And it's particularly difficult, I think, for poor women, minority women who are at risk, you know, to be able to access this type of medical care, to be able to access this type of testing. So it's got to be particularly hard for them to be seeing this plastered all over the news. But again, there are things and other ways to reduce risks that women should talk about with their doctors.
This has been fascinating. I hope you too will rejoin us. Dr. Baron Lerner, you just heard, a medical historian, professor of medicine at the New York University Langone Medical Center, author of a really important book, The Breast Cancer Wars, and Marsha Oakley, nursing coordinator of the Hofburger Breast Center at Mercy Hospital, a breast cancer survivor. It's the same center my wife went to when she was battling breast cancer. And I want to thank both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Been a pleasure to have you both. We're going to take a very brief break. When we come back, we're going to begin to look at kind of the political and social questions around who owns our genomic structure, how this affects breast cancer, what we can do and how we can receive treatment, how it affects poor women and more. And the Supreme Court is about to make a decision on this very issue around this gene. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you all with us. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can also join us on Facebook at Mark Steiner or the Mark Steiner Show, or you can tweet us, as they say in today's world, at Mark Steiner. We are joined here by Dr. Ellen Matloff, who is a research scientist in genetics, director of the Cancer Genetic Counseling of Cancer, director of Cancer Genetic Counseling at Yale University. Emily Kuczynski, who is genetic counselor at MedStar Franklin Square Medical Center here in Baltimore, Maryland, where we broadcast from. And Sandra Parker, Park, Sandra Park, excuse me, Sandra Park, who is Senior Staff Attorney with the ACLU Women's Project. Folks, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So I one of the things that hit me as soon as this happened with the piece that was written by Angelina Jolie, anybody who read it, most people who read it, I would say, had to be affected by that, any woman's story like that, whether it's her story or anybody else's. She wrote an effective piece, I thought. Her hearts went out to her. But then immediately there's an old high school friend of mine, Nancy Weinberg from Massachusetts, who wrote a piece on Facebook that really caught my attention. And the attention had to do with who owns our genetic property, what this test really means in terms of kind of limiting the kind of procedures and more. And then I read the pieces you were reading, writing, and things you've been quoted in Ellen Matloff. And the issue is much more complex than just the ability to pay for a $4,000 test and have this radical procedure, which women have the right to have and should have the right to have, to address their breast cancer or their potential breast cancer. But it goes deeper than that, Ellen Matloff.
I agree. I think that this issue with Angelina Jolie has brought home to all of us that knowing your genetic information could be critical to your future health and the health of your children. And for any single company to own your genes is simply ludicrous.
And that, I mean, and talk about, many people don't understand what's going on here. So that is the case at the moment.
And it is the case. They have a patent on BRCA1 and 2, and I will certainly let Sandra Park speak to the legal issues involved. But for those of us in the field, and my colleague can speak to what's happened at her center, but over the last 15 years, Myriad Genetics has enforced a monopoly on this testing. We've had to send every single sample to Myriad Genetics. Every other laboratory was shut down. They've controlled the pricing. They've controlled how the test was split off. They control all of the data. They hoard the data. They don't share it in public databases. And so all of your data, your BRCA1 and 2 genes, which we all have, are in fact controlled by this company.
And before we turn to Emily in the studio, because I want to get into how this affects people in their day-to-day work, working with women. Sandra Park, welcome. I'm glad you're with us.
Thank you.
And talk about that. I mean, this is the idea that we all have this genomic structure, women in their bodies, in our bodies. Do men have it as well, by the way?
Yes.
All of us have it.
Those genes,
okay.
Right.
Just double-checking. I thought we did. I wanted to make sure I was right. But the idea that because one quote unquote discovers its existence or something about it or its structure, that they should then own it. Is that what the argument is here?
Yes. What Myriad did, and they're not the only company that have patented genes, but what they did is they filed for patents on the BRCA1 and 2 genes, the genes themselves, once they identified them. And our argument is those genes are a product of nature, and under law, they cannot be patented. Myriad should certainly be recognized for its contribution to scientific knowledge, but just as Einstein contributed to scientific knowledge, and just as Dr. James Watson, when he found the double helix structure of DNA, did, you cannot get a patent on those scientific contributions.
And so what's the? I know they're not here today, but could you describe what the argument is on the other side, Sandra?
Sure. What their argument boils down to is that once that gene is removed from the cell in the body, they consider it a different chemical. But the fact is they did not transform that gene in any way. That gene still carries the same information genetically that you inherited from your parents. And so just as if you snapped a leaf off of a tree or removed a kidney from somebody's body, we don't think removing the gene from its natural environment makes it patentable.
So this is a very big issue. This case is going to be decided, an important issue in terms of, goes beyond breast cancer, goes beyond this gene. And it'll be decided this summer, correct? And if it is decided, however it's decided, what effect will it have? I mean, because knowing the Supreme Court, they can be very conservative and narrowly define it, or they can broadly define it.
Yes, the patents we challenged were granted by the Patent Office, and the Patent Office has granted thousands of other patents on genes. And those are connected to many other diseases, including colon cancer, Alzheimer's disease, muscular dystrophy. And so a court ruling on the issue of whether genes can be patented will certainly have an effect on all of those other patents as well.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead. Ellen, were you about to say something?
Oh, and those, similarly, those patents have an effect on medical practice. And so what I want to make clear is we are not challenging patents on tests or drugs. Those are certainly things that we think should be patented, where the patent incentive is appropriate and necessary. But by creating patents on genes, you're locking up that fundamental genetic information before all of those other companies and universities can use them to do research and make medical advancements.
Emily Kuczynski, your thoughts on this and how it affects your daily work.
Yeah, so I work here in Baltimore City, so I see a lot of patients throughout the MedStar system. So we have hospitals in Baltimore City.
And that shows your hospital specifically is a hospital that treats a lot of poor people.
Yes, yes. So we see a lot of people that have Medicaid or may have, you know, HMO insurances. So those insurances do cover the tests, but they may still have to pay, you know, 10 or 20%. And for my patients, a lot of times they can't afford that. I mean, they're worried about getting, you know, food on the table and buying, you know, things for their children. So they'd rather not pay the test and pay for the test. And it's unfortunate because they really do need it. And it could really help affect their treatment and also the medical management of their families.
This is, to me, some of the maddening part of all this. And at the end of the last hour, Dr. Baron Lerner, last half hour, I should say, made the comment about how this affects poor women and that it adversely affects people who are at the moderate low income scale in our country, Ellen Matloff. And it's like people who make $7 to $15 an hour, a woman who works and has two or three kids and or maybe has as many kids as Angelina Jolie has, and $800 for 20% or $400 is a huge amount of money. So that means that because this test is only controlled by one company, that these women who are poor women who may die from breast cancer cannot get the test.
I agree. And in fact, I would even take that statement a step further and say this isn't just lower socioeconomic status that's affected. This is people, I would say, who make under $100,000 who are affected.
Uh-huh, uh-huh,
because
yes.
When Myriad Genetics patented these genes and charged this much for the testing, they also did some other things, which, in my opinion, are really dirty pool. They split off the test and said, okay, we've figured out that our comprehensive BRAC analysis for $3,200 is missing a significant amount of mutations. So we've created an improvement to the test. And for that, we're going to charge you an extra $700. And insurance companies didn't pay for it for more than 6 years. They wouldn't let any other laboratory do that testing, which was very straightforward, even before they brought it to market. So I contacted them and said, look, I've got some high-risk families who've already had your test. They've already paid you. We didn't find a mutation in those families, and we know one exists. Please let us keep looking. And they said, no, it's a patent violation. So I would say that 95% of the patients who've gone through my office in the last 10 years have not had all of the testing of BRCA1 and 2 that they should have. And as a result of that, I can account for at least two people diagnosed with advanced cancers who likely will not be alive in 5 years.
That is unbelievable. You're sitting here shaking your head. Yes, this has been your experience as well, Emily?
Yeah, I agree with Ellen. There's definitely patients that because, you know, this additional test, the BART or the BRCA rearrangement test, has been recently added on. A lot of insurances don't see it as standard of care, and they're not covering it. And I have a lot of families. And it's interesting. It seems to be that in non-Caucasian families, they're finding that these large rearrangements exist more frequently. So families that, again, you know, really need it the most aren't able to get this additional testing that could possibly find a mutation. So I'm seeing that a lot as well. And it's very frustrating because it's an extra $700 that they would have to pay to do the test.
And I understand what you're saying, Ellen Matloff. I mean, I think when you said people make under $100,000, I mean, I think any of us who work hard for a living and make a decent salary and are lucky to make a decent salary, coming up with that kind of money is still a lot.
It's a lot of money out of pocket, especially in these economic times, and especially when people are already paying big bucks for their health insurance. To have to pay extra on top of that for services not covered because of a monopoly, it's craziness. We can't go on this way.
So I wonder, let me just take a step back. There's a medical question. I want to come back to Sandra with a kind of a political, social question here. But when we talk about this extra test that people want to do, the mutation of the gene,
the BART analysis, large rearrangement analysis.
So so what's the medical issue involved there? What's happening?
Well, there's certain mutations or changes within the BRCA genes that cannot be picked up by standard sequencing. So they do this large rearrangement analysis. They look for deletions and duplications that can't be picked up by the standard tests that they had been offering. So up to 11% of mutations can only be picked up by the second test. So we certainly are missing a lot of families and patients that could be BRCA positive, although their first test said that they were BRCA negative.
So that's frightening that this can be controlled in this way.
Well, and Mark, I think, if I may interrupt you, I think one thing that's really upsetting is that about 2 years ago, we saw this coming. We saw that patients weren't able to pay for BART analysis and that most of them were walking out of the office without them, and yet that Myriad was making huge profits in an era when everyone else was losing their jobs. So we did a petition, and we wrote it to Myriad. We had the top cancer geneticists and oncologists and geneticists in the world sign this petition, an open letter to Myriad. We sent it to them. We posted it. It was written about. They ignored it. We said, listen, please combine this into the test you're already doing that you call comprehensive. It's confusing. Doctors don't understand it. They're not ordering it. Patients can't afford it. People are going to die. Please act on this. And they didn't do it.
Sandra Park, this come back to an ACLU and others who are out there working on these issues. I know ACLU is not a community organizer, but I know you're involved with a number of people who are. I mean, where is – this is something I think, you know, when we have these kind of large movements at the moment to raise money around breast cancer – all the marches we have, the bike-a-thons, the walk-a-thons, the marathons, people being asked to wear pink ribbons and all that. And I asked my wife, who survived breast cancer who went through it, I should say, and she says, I don't want to wear these pink ribbons because I don't even know where the money's going. The politics of it is there's something wrong here. In other words, the alternative to that is kind of a movement demanding kind of change for this kind of thing. To me, it's outrageous that there's another test and they control it and no other women, mostly women, can get this.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I think one of the problems with this issue for too long has been that people turn off, when they hear about patents, when they hear about genetics, because those topics may not be familiar to many Americans. Fundamentally, this issue is a public health issue. It's an issue that all patients and all of us should care about. We all have genes. We all have genes that may have been patented. We all know people who are affected by these diseases. And ultimately, we need the public to be involved in this discussion because the patent office was going ahead and issuing these patents for many, many years without the kind of public scrutiny that we are now seeing with the Supreme Court litigation.
Folks, we'd like you to join us if you'd like. 410-319-8888. I want to hear your thoughts. I mean, so many of us out here listening and part of this public radio community here, WEAA, are people who are affected by this and people who have gone through this and what it says to you about we've had shows with around breast cancer on this program and both of our radio stations before for the last 20 years. But as this develops, there have been two glaring things. One is that we have seen that almost all the research money, let me take that back, a huge amount of the research money goes into genetic research, which affects 5 to 10% of the women who may be vulnerable for breast cancer, not to environmental causes, not to toxins that might be causing. We really don't know. But the research money is not going there because it might be too frightening for our society to understand what it means it has to do if they find out that is the root for some of our cancers in society, especially soft tissue cancer like breast cancer. And on the other hand, this idea that we can own our genetic structure, someone can own that and deny us the right to have certain tests, is something I think should make us all a little outraged and question. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. I'd really like to hear your thoughts on this, especially many of the men and women and families who have gone through this themselves. Do you see Ella Matloff kind of a before we go back to Emily, you can both comment on this. Any kind of collective outrage about this? Something that's being done on a broader scale?
I mean, there's certainly collective outrage in our community about it, but interestingly enough, and Emily, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this, many genetic counselors have been afraid to speak out against Myriad Genetics because they're one of the largest employers of genetic counselors in the country.
Hmm.
So what you see is that when a company like this builds, they get bigger and bigger. And long before the ACLU was involved, I, as an individual, tried to find a law firm who would take this case. And all sorts of law firms said, oh, this would be a great pro bono case. And then when they looked into it, they realized they had a financial conflict of interest because Myriad has so many investors. And I have to tell you, one of the very best days of my professional career was the day the ACLU called me and said they were taking this case. I will be eternally grateful to them, because DNA is the great equalizer. We all have it, and they care about it.
Amen. Emily?
Yeah, I agree. And I would like to applaud, you know, Ellen and Sandra and the other plaintiffs that are taking on Myriad, because it is, you know, they are a very powerful company, and there's, you know, is a lot of money in that company. So a lot of people aren't willing to take them on. But I definitely see where, you know, having that power of being the only company to offer the genetic test affects, you know, clinical practice. Several years ago, Myriad Genetics started a campaign where they were, you know, kind of bypassing genetic counselors, because, you know, genetic counselors are primed to offer testing to families because we have been trained to talk about, you know, the benefits and limitations of testing, who should have it, you know, who's the best person in the family to get tested, which is usually someone with cancer because they're most likely to test BRCA positive or positive for another genetic mutation. And then from there, we can test other family members. Well, Myriad several years ago kind of, you know, in interest of getting more tests, bypassed the genetic counselors and kind of went straight to the GYNs and said, you know, you should be offering this testing, you know, to your patients. And it's easy to do. It's just a blood test, or they can even do saliva. And so that's frustrating because now people are getting tested that probably shouldn't get tested. And, you know, the proper follow-up isn't getting done, because even though some of these women are negative, they still have a family history that needs to be addressed, and they may need, you know, increased surveillance through breast MRI or other you know, chemo prevention options. So it's frustrating to see what this control that they have has done and how they market their test. And, you know, it's not always what you think in the best interest of our patients and families. So that's been frustrating on my end.
And let me just say, go ahead. Know. I'm sorry, Ellen, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, you know, we've been able to document, since Myriad did these campaigns, that there have been some women who had the surgery Angelina Jolie has had,
mm-hmm.
and then they later learn that they didn't carry a mutation. Their test result was misinterpreted because Myriad is pounding the pavement, asking people, physicians without a background in genetics, to order this testing themselves. And the interesting thing is that the Myriad sales reps are pocketing the commission they make on every test,
wow.
but the physicians get all the liability, and now we're seeing them getting sued by women who've had their breasts or ovaries removed preventatively and then are later told, oops, we made a mistake. You didn't carry a mutation. We interpreted your result inaccurately. And what Myriad is now doing, they've seen these published papers showing that this was a mistake. What they're doing now is they have a website that you can go on and learn to do genetic testing yourself. There's even great rumors, substantiated rumors, that they now want mammography techs to do their own genetic testing. Mark, this is a disaster.
Say that last sentence you just said. They do what?
They are asking mammography techs who have no training, no medical training, and other than taking a mammogram, and no genetics training, to do their own genetic testing without a genetic counselor. So when a patient comes in from a mammogram, they're training these techs to tell them about genetic testing, take a saliva sample, and send it off.
I'm going to just say that we did ask Myriad to join us today. They never called us back. I called them several times over the last couple of days since this Angelina Jolie story broke to have them on, but they never called us back. So we always try to get everyone on the show, even though we might have a point of view. We try to be very honest in our discussions and bring everybody to the table, but they didn't want to come to the table. Sandra Park, so of what we're talking about here, how much of this is part of the legal case?
A lot of it is, because the Supreme Court's doctrine has said we can't patent products of nature. And the reason we can't is because the court has recognized that things in nature should be available to everyone in the scientific community to study and to advance our knowledge on. And so all of the concerns and impacts of the patents that Ellen and Emily have talked about in terms of the effects on patients, the ability of Myriad to control the price, the quality of the testing and the data, those are all concerns that inform the legal inquiry into whether these patents actually preempt or foreclose future scientific innovation rather than spurring it on. And our argument is that these patents do that. They're a barrier for that kind of medical advancement.
Nancy, written on Facebook, said there's also a test they offer for under $1,000 that I think tests specifically the marker carried by Ashkenazi Jews. Please ask if the tests or the other tests are available from other labs outside the United States.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, so testing is available from other labs outside the United States, but you know, we're not able to send them to those other labs, so we have to use Myriad Genetics.
Ellen,
we offer the testing for the three common Jewish mutations here at Yale, and we have to pay Myriad Genetics every time we do that. But it's such a small charge for them that they've allowed us to do that testing. We can also test people for a single familial mutation here. But the majority of the, you know, high price testing goes to Myriad.
Are there other tests by ethnicity, or is it pretty much that the only one?
So far, there aren't, but really there should be. And if there were not a monopoly on this testing, I think that other laboratories would offer, for example, a panel for French Canadians, a panel for people of Hispanic origin, where there are certain mutations that are much more common. And we could do it in ways that made sense and that cost less, but we're not allowed to.
And when you said earlier, just very quickly, I wanted to our listeners understand this, and you said, and please both Emily and Ellen comment on this and jump in as well, Sandra, but you said, Ellen, that I believe it was you who said this, that Myriad is kind of coining the market on genetic counselors. You both do, I know that you're a genetic counselor, Emily, and you're a researcher, Ellen, but what does that mean that they are cornering the market on genetic counselors, and how do they bypass people who work in a hospital like you do?
Well, I'm actually also a genetic counselor, just like Emily.
Uh-huh.
And Myriad Genetics is just offering jobs to genetic counselors in a market where a lot of hospitals don't have a lot of money right now, particularly now with cuts to Medicaid and Medicare and the sequester. And they are offering them jobs, and they're paying them a lot more than a hospital like where Emily and I work can pay. And so a lot of people are going to those jobs, and in some ways it's difficult to blame them. You got to support a family. You got to have a job. And so they have become a big player in the field of genetic counseling, and this is a controversial topic. Emily, I don't know if you want to touch it, but for example, even to say something on our national listserv about Myriad Genetics in a negative tone, boy, that is really frowned upon. So, you know, it's become very heated and controversial, and I can tell you, I'm not necessarily a good guy considered by everyone in my profession because of it.
Emily?
Yeah, it is hard, you know, to speak against them because there's so many genetic counselors that are hired by Myriad, and you know they always kind of frame what they're doing in the context that we're trying to just help the patients. We're trying to get as many people tested as can be, but again, they don't always, you know, targeting the right people. They're testing patients that don't have suspicious family histories, or you know, maybe someone else in the family with cancer should be tested first. So it's very frustrating. And like Ellen was saying earlier, you know, GYNs or you know, mammotechs are doing this testing, and they're taking you know 5 minutes to explain it. Whereas genetic counselors, we spend an hour with the patient, you know, going through their family history and going through the benefits and limitations of testing. So it's very frustrating in that respect.
And we understand the information, right, Emily? I mean, this is another
exactly.
difference. These other professionals understand their area; they don't understand genetics, Mark.
Exactly. This is a very critical conversation we're having, and we have maybe less than a minute left. Sandra, when will the case be? When will we know the decision?
We expect the court will issue their decision before the end of the term, which ends at the end of June.
Well, we'll see what happens. We have emails coming in now. I wish I got them a little earlier, but I would have read them. But maybe I'll read this one at the very top of the next hour. So we have to take a break now, don't we? And we'll read this from Ann Gutman, another fellow high school graduate who is outraged by this conversation. So I'll read her comment when we come back from this break, because we all should hear what she had to say. Ellen Matloff, Director of Cancer Genetic Counseling at Yale University. Emily Kuczynski, Genetic Counselor at MedStar Franklin Square Medical Center. Sandra Park, Senior Staff Attorney with the ACLU Women's Project. I want to thank you all three for joining us and being so forthright and fearless in your work on this, and helping women and confronting what needs to be confronted. Thank you, three of you, so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a very brief break, folks. Don't go away. Come back with a new discussion top of the hour. We've been seeing a lot about Cleveland and abductions. We're actually going to speak with a woman who was abducted as a young child, doesn't know who she really is, and her work to help other women like her. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. On our way to our conversation, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. For more information, www.mecu.com, or you can go to our website, steinershow.org, and click on the banner. It's there 24/7. www.mecu.com for MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Before we jump into our conversation, I also remind you that please join us tonight. Michelle Martin's coming to WEAA tonight. You know, she's on the air now, follows us at 11 a.m. with Tell Me More. Michelle Martin, host of NPR's Tell Me More, and Anthony McCarthy and I are inviting you to join us for a meet-and-greet reception here in the WEAA studios. That's this today, Thursday, May 16th, 4 to 7 p.m. It's open to all. Call 443-885-3654 to let them know you're coming. But please join us here, and we look forward to meeting all of our listeners and having conversations with you all tonight, and light refreshments and more for a few hours. And it's going to be a great event, as is this new incredible morning lineup here on WEAA. On the way to our conversation, I said I would read this email about what occurred in our last hour. And I just saw it come in at the very end, so I did not have a chance to read it. It was my fault for not looking more carefully, but it's important. Ann Gutman wrote this in, and she wrote, "My mother had bilateral breast cancer way back in 1958-59. The second cancer was very invasive and a very different type than the first. 34 years ago, I was 28 and had breast cancer. I had a radical mastectomy and opted for the second prophylactic mastectomy so I would not follow in my mother's footsteps. I've always questioned that wisdom. I prayed for the BRCA testing 8 years ago and announced to my family that I did not carry the gene. 6 years ago, my daughter had the same BRCA my mother and I had and has had a mastectomy. We discussed a second prophylactic mastectomy, but the docs at Hopkins decided they'd be watching her so closely it would not be necessary. A year later, she developed invasive breast cancer in her second breast. She had a second mastectomy, chemo followed by tamoxifen. and now is succumbing to stage 4 disease and is on heavy chemo. She finally got the insurance to pay for genetic testing to see if she carries the gene for treatment purposes. She does not. There are many females in our family having no idea what to do. The decisions are not always clear and easy. So sad, writes Anne. So I think that we will follow up on some more of this maybe in the coming weeks. This whole idea of people being able, companies being able to own our genetic structure and stop us from getting the tests we want because we can't afford it, I think is outrageous in our society and something we have to address. So I want to thank you all for listening to being part of this, and please go to our website. We're going to have all the information from our guests in the previous hour there, their articles, their ideas, what they're saying, so you can follow along with this because this is something that we can't just sit by and allow to happen.